I have prenatal exams all afternoon, and Anne will assist me. We can talk about this whole affair then.
Oh, I don't think so, Sybil, BP said slowly. If Anne hasn't already called you, I wouldn't expect her tomorrow. When you made the incision into Mrs. Bedford to rescue the baby, she says she saw blood spurt a couple of times. She says she thinks Mrs. Bedford was alive.
After BP spoke, the stillness that overtook the three adults and me was not the silence that grows from serenity, the hush that flowers around minds at peace. It was the stillness of waiting, of anticipation tinged, no, not tinged, overwhelmed by gloom. I took in a few deep breaths to try and calm myself, to settle my stomach. But my knees were going, and so I gave in. I allowed my body to slide to the kitchen floor, and then the stillness brought on by words was done in by words.
What did you say to Anne when she called? I heard my father ask. I told her I doubted what she said was true. I told her I'd already spoken to you and Andre, and my sense was she probably saw a lot of blood, and it was probably very frightening. But she hadn't seen you cut open a living woman. It just wasn't possible, given who you are.
Who I am, my mother murmured.
Yes, an experienced midwife, a woman with excellent emergency medical training.
And then? My father again.
She seemed to understand, and I hoped that would be the end of it. I suggested she call you and get it all off her chest.
But she never called me, my mother said. And in her voice I heard as much hurt as I heard fear.
Apparently not. But later that day she did call Reverend Bedford.
She called Asa?
And then she called the state's attorney's office.
And she told them she thought this woman had been alive when Sybil did the C-section? My father asked.
So it would seem. What she probably told the state's attorney, and this is why I wanted to come by tonight, is that she and Asa both saw blood spurt when you made your incision. In her opinion, the heart was pumping when you began the operation.
Then why didn't she say something? My mother said, raising her voice for the first time that evening. No, she knew Charlotte was dead, and Asa did too. My mother wasn't frantic, but her tone suggested she understood clearly that Asa's perception of the tragedy affected everything. My father, perhaps, with some cause, feared that frenzy was just another revelation away, and asked quickly, BP, why are you here tonight, this moment? Did something happen today?
I was interviewed by a couple of state troopers. They wanted a statement. And based on their questions, I got the distinct impression that everyone, state's attorney, medical examiner, father, believes that somebody's dead right now because a midwife performed a bedroom cesarean on a living woman.
Later that night, my mother knocked on my door. Come on in, I said, rolling over in bed to face the doorway and tossing the magazine I was reading onto my night table. You're up late, she said.
It's the coffee,
I told her, teasing. I'd seen how closely she'd watched me that morning when I decided to test one of my limits. She picked up the magazine, One for Women, and thumbed through its pages. She skimmed the headlines and captions in the section on birth control.
How are you and Tom doing?
Fine.
Don't ever forget. When you think it's time, you tell me. We'll go straight to the clinic.
The clinic was our word-saving shorthand for Planned Parenthood.
I will.
Promise? I rolled my eyes.
Mom?
She rolled her eyes and threw back her head histrionically in response.
Promise?
She asked again. A reference to the vow she'd asked me to make when I turned 13, that if I ever thought there was even the slightest chance I might be having sex in the foreseeable future, we would visit Planned Parenthood and get me fitted for a diaphragm. When I told some of my friends about this promise, girls like Raleigh and Sadie, they decided that there was no mother on the planet as cool as my mom.
I promise, I said.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
How does your ankle feel?
It feels okay, she shrugged. Painkillers.
They work?
You bet.
What did Dr. Hewitt want? You weren't listening?
I couldn't hear everything. He's a good friend, she said, instead of answering my question. Think I'm on my own for the prenatals tomorrow.
Anne doesn't do much yet anyway, does she?
She does her share. She's learning. It sounds like she's got a lot to learn. My mother looked at me for a long moment, and I worked hard to maintain eye contact. I think she realized in that second just how much I understood, how much she needed to share with me, and how much she didn't. Her head nodded just the tiniest bit. Yes, that nod agreed. She does. Finally, I looked down at the edge of my quilt, unable to meet my mother's gaze any longer. "Sleep well, sweetie," she said. "Sweet dreams." "You too, Mom," I answered. And somewhere inside her, she found the strength to murmur the lie that she would. 25,000. A 2 and a 5 and 3 zeros. Until today, Rand and I had never written one check that big. And that 25,000 is just the beginning. "The retainer to get the clock started," Stephen Hastings said. "The money to feed the meter. And now the meter's running." I told Rand it was too much money, especially since we'll need a lot more if this thing drags on. It's almost our entire life savings, for Connie's college or our retirement, or both. Besides, I haven't done anything wrong. And so I said to Rand maybe we didn't have to have the best lawyer money could buy. It's not like I was caught robbing a bank. But Rand disagreed and said it didn't matter whether I'd done anything wrong. The point was that a woman had died doing something we all know the state hates, and so someone will have to be held accountable. In the old days, of course, he would have called the state the establishment. In my mind, I can see Rand shaking his head, and I can hear him saying, "Man, it will take a lot of bread to beat the establishment." He didn't say that, of course. He wouldn't, not these days. What he said was, "We want the best, and apparently that's Stephen Hastings. We shouldn't be surprised that he's the most costly." Rand is probably right. But given who I am and what I do, Stephen Hastings is a very ironic choice. In the world of law, Stephen's as pricey as they come. He's polished and high-tech and very, very slick. Meanwhile, in the world of babies, I'm about as inexpensive as you get, a fraction of the cost of an OBGYN. And I try hard to be unpolished and low-tech and earthy. And it sounds like Stephen was in Vietnam. I find that very weird, too. Imagine this. It's a single day 14 years ago. On one side of the planet, I'm in Plattsburgh, putting daisies all over the wire fence at the airbase and in the gun barrels of the soldiers. And somewhere on the other side of the planet, there's Stephen Hastings, up to his hips in some swamp or rice paddy, and now that guy's defending me. I do believe this will all be fine in the end, at least partly because Stephen seems to be such a good lawyer, but also because I was trying to do the right thing when I decided to save Vale. Stephen seems to understand that. From the Notebooks of Sybil Danforth, Midwife. How high does blood spurt from a beating heart? For my mother, the question lost its rhetorical or theoretic flourish and became instead one of pathological and clinical detail. For Stephen Hastings, however, the issue became one of mere staging and lighting, logistics, not pathology. Although my mother's fate would indeed depend in large measure upon who would win the battle of the experts Stephen waged with Bill Tanner, his doctors versus the state's, his midwives versus theirs, on this one question he didn't worry much about medical testimony. He worried instead about blocking and where Asa Bedford and Ann Austin were standing when my mother took a kitchen knife and first pierced Charlotte's skin.
"Stephen Hastings. And then you asked if your wife was dead. Asa Bedford."
"Yes, sir."
"And Sybil told you she was?"
"That's right."
"So, you looked out the window. Did you watch it snow?"
"I don't remember, but I probably did. At least for a second or two. But then I looked back at Charlotte."
"From the window?"
"Yes, sir."
Hastings motions toward easel with overhead drawing of the Bedford bedroom. "How far is the window from the bed?"
Bedford: "Not far. A couple of feet."
"2 feet?"
"No, further."
Hastings, at easel: "Using the state's diagram, it's 6 feet 8 inches from the center of the bed to the glass. Does that sound right to you?"
"It sounds fine. Thank you."
"Was the sun up?"
"No, sir. It was still dark out."
"And so the only light in the room
came from the lamps.
Yes, but I could see Charlotte.
Hastings motions toward diagram. Was the floor light on, the one in the corner?
Yes, that one had been on all night long.
What about the one on the night table?
Yes, that one was on too. Mrs. Danforth had turned it on just before she began the operation.
Where was Sybil standing during the operation? On which side of the bed?
The far side, the side away from me.
Here?
Yes, sir.
Hastings presses a bright blue dot onto the drawing beside the bed. This is Sybil. Presses a red dot onto the drawing just inside the window. And this is you. Is this accurate?
I think so.
In other words, your wife was in bed and the bed was between you and Sybil.
Exactly. From the window, I had an unobstructed view.
Hastings presses a yellow dot on top of the night table behind the defendant. And this is the light Sybil switched on just before she rescued your baby?
Yes.
Hastings presses a second yellow dot in the corner of the bedroom behind the defendant. And this is the light that was on most of the night?
Right.
Is it a bright light?
No, it's soft, which is why we used it for the birth. Mrs. Danforth wanted the lights to be low.
And the lamp by the bed, was that a bright light?
In my opinion, it was. It was our reading light.
Bright enough to cast a shadow.
I guess.
And the lamp was on?
The lamp was on.
Where was the shadow?
On the bed.
Hastings presses finger in middle of bed. Where on the bed would that shadow have fallen? Here?
Probably.
What was in the middle of the bed the night your son was born?
My wife, of course.
The shadow from the lamp fell on your wife?
Yes.
On her torso?
I guess.
Thank you. Do you remember what Sybil was wearing that night?
I think she was wearing a sweater and blue jeans.
A ski sweater?
Yes.
Do you remember what color it was?
No, sir.
Hastings shows article of clothing to state's attorney and Judge Dorset. Sweater is admitted into evidence. Is this the sweater Sybil was wearing?
Bedford. I think so.
What color is it? Navy blue, and the snowflakes around the shoulders and collar are white.
But it's mostly navy blue.
Mostly. We've established that Vale was born sometime between 6:15 and 6:20 in the morning, correct?
Correct.
Did you sleep at all the night before?
No, I did not.
Do you remember what time you got up the day before, Thursday?
It was probably around 6:30.
So you'd been awake for just about 24 hours?
Yes.
Were your eyes tired?
It's possible.
Now, you've told the court that you think you may have seen this bit of blood spurt, despite the fact that you were almost 7 feet away when it happened. Am I correct?
Yes.
And despite the fact that your wife's stomach was covered in shadow.
Correct.
Yes. And despite the fact that you would have seen this blood against the backdrop of a navy blue ski sweater.
Right?
Yes, but, and despite the fact that you had been awake all night long. No, not just all night, a full 24 hours. Is that the testimony you actually want the jury to believe? I know what I saw. Did you believe your wife was dead when you went to the window?
Oh, yes.
Did you love her?
Of course.
Were you sad?
Good Lord, yes.
Were you very sad?
Yes.
And was it in that frame of mind that you think you saw blood spurt?
Yes, but I was not hysterical. I'm telling you, I know what I saw.
And yet, did you make any effort at all, to stop Sybil when you saw the blood?
No. As I told Mr. Tanner, I thought it was normal. I assumed my Charlotte had passed away, and this was just what the body did.
Stephen was firmly convinced that no husband in his right mind would actually have brought himself to witness a knife going into his dead wife's belly, and that was the real reason Asa had gone to the window. But first, he told my parents, he would cast doubt upon what Asa could have seen from the bedroom that morning. Stephen's cross-examination of the Reverend began right after lunch and continued until we recessed for the day. There were moments that afternoon, brief but thrilling, when I was convinced with the confidence of a teenager that Stephen had persuaded every soul in the courtroom that it wasn't logical to believe Asa Bedford would actually have watched his wife's cesarean, and it was unlikely he could have seen blood spurt even if illogic had somehow prevailed. But when the cross-examination was over,
The fact remained that Asa Bedford was still a clergyman. In our corner of the kingdom in 1981, this meant his words had weight, great weight. I thought Stephen's cross-examination had been wonderful, but when we all went to our separate homes for dinner, I nevertheless feared one cross-examination, even a good one, could not undo a week of damaging medical testimony and the memories of the minister. As spring became summer and Stephen steeped himself in the culture of home birth, he concluded that the women who became doctors viewed themselves as physicians first, OBGYNs second. Those girls who became midwives, on the other hand, knew midwifery was their calling at a very early age, or, as my mother's path suggested, had one profound, life-changing experience involving birth that pulled them in. Yet did I become an obstetrician simply because I wanted to be a doctor, and I happened to grow up in a house that made me comfortable with the anatomic terrain? I doubt it. And after watching the way some OBGYNs clinically picked my mother apart in the courthouse, it's arguable I might have developed such a visceral distaste for the entire profession that I would have become anything but a baby doctor. To this day, some of my mother's friends think I've betrayed her by becoming an OBGYN. But my choice of profession was neither an indictment of my mother's calling nor a slap at her persecutors. I learned from my mother that how babies come into this world indeed matters. I learned from her detractors that most babies come into this world in hospitals. In my opinion, I do a lot of good in delivery rooms and ORs, and I've never once had a prenatal exam that took less than half an hour. I get to know my mother's well. Stephen brought in the specialists fast, even before my mother was charged with a crime. In addition to a photographer, he immediately hired an accident reconstructionist to examine the slope and width of the Bedford's driveway. He wanted to be sure that there could be no doubt in a jury's mind that my mother had done everything humanly possible to try and transfer Mrs. Bedford to the hospital the night that she died. And he probably spent entire days on the phone, tracking down midwives around the country who'd been tried for one reason or another. He found forensic pathologists and obstetricians who could serve as our expert witnesses should they be needed, some willing to come from as far away as Texas. And although Stephen may not have been particularly interested in the specifics of how high blood might spurt, there were some medical issues that mattered to him greatly, including, of course, Charlotte Fugit Bedford's cause of death. Stephen wanted to be sure that we had our explanation for why the woman had died, especially after the autopsy was complete and it was clear that the state was going to contend there had been no cerebral aneurysm and that the cause of death was therefore Sybil Danforth. With the help of his specialists, in those first weeks, Stephen began developing lists, long litanies of the complications that can occur in any birth, home, or hospital. The specialist who became most involved with us as a family, however, actually knew as little about home birth in the beginning as Stephen. Patty Dunleavy was a private investigator, the state's first female PI. Stephen Hastings chose her as an investigator first and foremost, he said, because she was without question the best in Vermont. But given the issues surrounding my mother's case, we all understood the fact that she was a woman wouldn't hurt either. Patty fast became a role model of sorts for Raleigh McKenna and me. We met her together on a Wednesday afternoon less than a week after Charlotte Bedford had died. The two of us were grooming witchgrass in the section of the McKenna's paddock nearest the road when Patty's white car, a sleek foreign thing, squealed to a stop by the fence. The woman driving pulled off mirrored sunglasses and rolled down the window to ask if either of us knew where someone named Sybil Danforth lived. "Does she know you're coming?" I asked warily. "Sure does. You must be her daughter." "What makes you think so? You're looking out for her?" "I'm Patty Dunleavy. I work with Stephen Hastings, your mom's lawyer." The woman was in her late 30s or early 40s, but her hair was still an almost electric strawberry blonde. That afternoon, she was wearing the sort of tailored black leather jacket one was more likely to find on the back of a Park Avenue debutante than a biker. But we learned quickly that Patty was a chameleon, which was one of the reasons she was so good at what she did. I know when she interviewed my mother's clients or other midwives that spring and summer, she was likely to be dressed in billowy peasant skirts. When she visited physicians or hospital administrators, she'd appear in madras skirts and well-ironed blouses. And once I understood that Patty Dunleavy wasn't a reporter, I liked her right away. Raleigh and I both did. I climbed into the car and served as co-pilot for the 500 yards separating the McKennas from the Danforths. "What are you going to do for my mother?" She smiled. Well, for starters, I'm going to get from her the name of every single person on this planet who will say something nice about her if we ask them to testify. Then we'll begin figuring out exactly what I'm going to do for her. You'll have a long list, you know. Of people who like her? Terrific. It's always a special treat when Steven actually has me working for the good guys. I'm not superstitious now, and I wasn't in 1981. In my mind, it is merely ironic, not symbolic, that Charlotte Fugit Bedford went into labor on the 13th of March, and that the results of the written autopsy arrived on the first day of April, April Fool's Day. April 1st was a Tuesday that year, and in my parents' attempts to give our lives a small semblance of normalcy, they had insisted I try out for the junior varsity track team as we discussed throughout the winter. Tryouts began on Tuesday, and so I didn't get home that afternoon until close to dinner. But there had been enough conversation about the imminent submission of the written autopsy in our house in the weeks since Charlotte Bedford had died that I could tell instantly by my parents' silence and the presence of a bottle of scotch on the kitchen table that its final conclusions had offered only bad news. As my mother rose from her seat and began to serve dinner, my father told me what I already knew. The medical examiner had found no signs of a stroke, no indications of a seizure. Immediate cause of death? Hemorrhagic shock due to a cesarean section during home childbirth. Birth is a big miracle foreshadowed by lots of little ones. Conception, the quickening, the turning, the descent. I will never forget the moment of quickening with Connie. I was sitting on one of the tremendous rocks in Mom and Dad's backyard. Rand and I had decided by then we were going to get married, but the little one inside me wasn't the reason. She was just the signal that we might as well do it sooner rather than later. I hadn't climbed those rocks since I was in high school, and sitting there made me feel like a very little girl. And then suddenly I felt this tiny flutter, and I wrapped my arms around me and hugged my baby through my belly. Oh my God, was I happy. Of all the little miracles that built to that big one, the birth itself, my favorite must be the moment of quickening. All these emotions and expectations and dreams for your baby just roll over you. And quickening really is the perfect word to describe it, because your heart races and the pace of the pregnancy just takes off. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. April is neither holy spring nor holy winter in Vermont. It's common for there to be flurries, maybe even a few inches of heavy, wet snow one day, and then hot sun and temperatures in the high 60s the next. Although my family understood on the first of the month that my mother would be charged with a crime, it wasn't until a little later in April that the state had determined exactly what that crimes actually, would be. Consequently, throughout the first week and a half of the month, our emotions rode a roller coaster with more pronounced peaks and dips than even our almost malevolently capricious weather could erect on its own. Stephen had warned my parents on the very first day they had met that the state might suggest that my mother had willfully killed Charlotte Bedford, and she should therefore be charged with second-degree murder. The difference between second-degree and involuntary manslaughter wasn't small. Second-degree came with a decade in prison, if there were mitigating factors, and up to a lifetime, if there weren't. Involuntary manslaughter simply implied that my mother had acted with gross negligence, and therefore came with a mere 1 to 15 years behind bars. There was never any doubt about the lesser charge, however, the misdemeanor, practicing medicine without a license. That, Stephen said, was inevitable. Nevertheless, despite Stephen's warning and his reassurance that a charge of second degree was unlikely, the first time Bill Tanner suggested that the state might try seriously to build the case that my mother's actions were willful, my father grew furious, my mother grew frightened, and they both grew confused. I sat on the stairs of our house one night, listening as they spoke to Stephen on the telephone, my mother from the phone on the first floor, my father from the phone on the second. I know what the words intentional and involuntary mean to a normal person, my father was saying. I want to know what the hell they mean to lawyers. I see. The woman was already dead, for God's sake. Why would Sybil have thought a C-section would kill her? A moment later, my mother added, her voice almost frantic, how can they say that? I'd already told Asa she died. But I can't imagine Stephen got far into a response to her exclamation, because my father almost immediately cut in again. I thought if you killed someone, you were supposed to have a motive. But there's no goddamn reason why she would have desired to affect the death of that woman. There's just no reason. Oh, that's stupid. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Oh, I hope they do say that, because they wouldn't have a fucking chance of winning, right? Right?
When it was clear that the conversation was winding down, I left my perch on the stairs and went into the living room and acted as if I'd been reading my biology textbook all along. Almost immediately, my father came downstairs and joined my mother in the kitchen.
Let me make sure I've got this right, my father said. They're gonna say you killed Charlotte Bedford on purpose.
They might say that. Apparently they haven't decided anything.
Okay, they might say you killed Charlotte Bedford on purpose.
I guess.
To save the baby.
Yes, they might say I thought Charlotte was going to die, but I had to know full well she was alive when I did the cesarean.
You had to.
I had to. I couldn't possibly do what I do for a living without being able to tell the difference. I couldn't possibly have made such a mistake.
And you did it to save the baby.
The C-section? Yep, so they think. A long silence. Then an echo from my father.
Yep, so they think.
Sib? My father continued after another quiet moment.
Yes?
I want to ask something. I'll only ask it this one time, and I'll never ask it again. But I have to know. I have to ask.
Don't even think of it. Don't even think of asking it. I can't have you doubting me, too.
You answered it. That's all I wanted to hear.
Don't doubt me, Rand.
I don't.
My mother had spent almost uncountable days and nights bringing life into the world. It didn't seem fair to me that her trial revolved around the notion that she could mistake it for death in the end. Here's how our emotional roller coaster worked. No sooner had my parents begun to pull themselves up from the almost debilitating despair and self-doubt inspired by the possibility of a second-degree murder trial than Stephen reassured them that the charge was unlikely. Almost as if we'd been diagnosed with a terminal disease, the sort of news that would once have appalled us was thrilling. I'm in remission. I might have 2 whole years to live? That's wonderful. Involuntary manslaughter only? Oh my, that's great. I was surprised when I came home from track practice one afternoon later that week to find my mother and Stephen sitting on the front porch of our house. It was one of those wondrous April days with a hot sun shining above a cold, still, sloshy ground. They stopped talking and smiled at me when they saw me at the end of our driveway, and I could sense the lawyer had arrived with good news. Was I surprised that Stephen had come all the way from Burlington to meet with my mother? A drive closer to 90 minutes than an hour, rather than call? I was, briefly. And it was that night at dinner that my father made the first of a great many catty comments about Stephen that I believe he came to regret. But my first reaction when I saw Stephen sitting there was that he would be a good friend for my mother, and he would certainly do his best to protect her. If he had feelings for her that most attorneys would have deemed unprofessional, that could only be to our benefit.
"How'd it go today, honey?"
she asked, referring to practice.
"Good, fine."
"Legs sore?"
"Nope, not a bit."
"Your mom tells me you made the track team," Stephen said. "Just the junior varsity," I told him, a meaningful correction in my mind. "In 8th grade, that's still a mighty accomplishment," he said.
I nodded and stared at my sneakers, my way then of graciously accepting a compliment. "Mr. Hastings says I'm not in as much trouble as we thought the other night." My mother offered a tiny grin that seemed sincere and brave to me at the same time, but I think now was probably ironic. "It looks like they don't think your mom is a murderer. They just think your old lady's one really lousy midwife."
Stephen bent to wipe some dry dirt from his one click above shiny black loafers and said, "Sybil, they think that one time, you made a mistake.
A gross mistake. A reckless mistake." Stephen stared at my mother, and I could see by the expression on his face that he was trying to put the brakes on her emotions, to calm her down for my benefit.
"What kind of a trial will it be?"
I asked.
"Involuntary manslaughter. At least that's what it looks like right now."
"Do you understand what that means, sweetie?" my mother asked.
"Sort of." "What that means," Stephen continued, "is that the state is going to say your mom was responsible for Mrs. Bedford's death, and she acted illegally when she did the C-section, but it was an accident. She didn't mean to hurt anyone."
"If they think it was an accident, why are they bothering to have a trial?"
"Just because something is an accident doesn't mean it isn't also a crime."
"That's the manslaughter thing, right?"
"The involuntary manslaughter thing. That's right."
15 years. For an accident. I stood there, trying to absorb a number of years longer than I'd been alive.
When will the trial begin? I asked.
Months from now, hopefully years, Stephen said.
Years?
If it even goes to trial.
Stephen, I don't want this thing to drag on, my mother said.
Delay is our friend, Sybil.
Why?
He shrugged. A case like this always starts out with a lot of prosecutorial energy, and it always loses momentum over time. Bill has to focus on prosecuting the real bad guys, not some nice lady midwife like Sybil Danforth. And all of those doctors who seem so angry right now will move on to other things. It's one of those strange absolutes no lawyer completely understands. But delay always benefits the defense. The last thing we want is for this thing to go to trial before Christmas, or even spring.
What makes you think this thing might not go to trial?
My mother asked. Perhaps we can settle things ahead of time.
What does that mean? I pay a fine and I get on with my life?
No, it's more complicated than that.
Tell me, what would we be negotiating?
It might be the charge. And if we agree on that, it might be the sentence.
The sentence, she said, a tiny but unmistakable sliver of panic shooting through her voice. I haven't done anything wrong.
Well, a sentence may not even be an issue, so let's not talk about it now. Fair enough?
No, I want you to go on.
Okay. Let's suppose the state has an airtight case, a case we just can't win. There's no way. In return for no jail time, we plead guilty, and you get a suspended sentence and a couple of years probation. Your life goes on, more or less, as it always has. Except there's this probation officer you see every so often, and you give up midwifery.
Slowly, sounding at once oddly drugged and unshakably determined, each syllable in each word a declaration itself, my mother said, "That's not an option, Stephen. I could never give that up. I never will give that up."
"I doubt it will even come to that," Stephen murmured after a minute.
"You don't believe that. You believe that it will."
"I don't know. And I won't know for months."
Months.
Perhaps even longer. Like I said, delay helps us a lot more than them.
I don't want this to drag on.
I understand. And I won't stop birthing babies.
I heard the sound of my father's Jeep as he pulled into our driveway.
"I think you'll have to, Sybil, at least for a while."
The Jeep's door slammed and my mother waved at my father. "Please, Stephen," she said, her voice not loud enough for my father to hear. "Get this over and done with fast, as quickly as possible. The longer it..." "Please, Stephen," she said again. "Fast, for the sake of me and my family. Get this over with fast."
Years later, when my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer, an adenocarcinoma, the sort of non-smoker's most likely to get, I saw my father become an exquisite caregiver. He was, I can say without reservation or qualification, an exceptional cancer coach, part nurse, part dietitian, part partner and soulmate, part Newt Rockne. But of course, my mother was not diagnosed with cancer in 1981. She was charged with a felony. Consequently, my mother didn't need a nurse or a dietitian or a cancer coach. She needed a lawyer. And so I think it was natural that to a large extent that role of caregiver fell more upon Stephen Hastings' shoulders than upon my father's, and that my father was jealous. He wanted to help. He wanted responsibilities. He wanted more things to do. I watched my parents carefully the night Stephen stopped by with his news, and it was clear that my mother had lost sight of the good tidings he'd brought her behind the bad. Undoubtedly, she was relieved that in all likelihood the state would charge her with involuntary manslaughter instead of second-degree murder. But this information had been overshadowed by the idea that she would have to stop birthing babies for some period of time. Perhaps forever.
"What am I supposed to do? Tell someone like May O'Brien that I can't help her have her baby?" she asked my father that night as she picked at the food on her plate.
"I guess you'll have to refer her to someone else," my father said. "Maybe Tracy Fitzpatrick.
Tracy lives in Burlington, for God's sakes. She's too far away from most of my mother's."
"What about Cheryl?"
"Cheryl Visco doesn't have a moment to breathe."
Without looking up from his plate, my father asked, "What did Stephen say you should do?"
He didn't have a solution.
"Really? We stumped the stars?"
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"I thought our $100-an-hour lawyer had the answer to everything."
"Did I miss a step somewhere? Did Stephen say something to you today that pissed you off?"
Do I sound pissed off?
Yes, you do. Honestly, did Stephen say something that angered you?
No.
Then why this tone?
I just think it's odd that he drove all the way out here this afternoon.
What's odd about it? He's our lawyer.
It just seems to me that he shouldn't be driving all the way out here to give you information he could just as easily give you on the phone. It seems financially irresponsible. It seems like he's awfully cavalier with money, with our money.
Maybe lawyers don't charge for driving.
And maybe there's a fish with wings out back in the pond.
If I worked in Burlington, I'd want to get away as much as possible, I said.
Is that so? My mother asked me. She smiled slightly, and it was clear she didn't believe a word I'd said.
Yep. Get away from all that noise. All those cars.
All those record stores, she added. That big mall with all those clothing stores on Church Street.
I'm not saying a city's all bad, I explained. It's just that if you're there every day, it's probably fun to come out here every once in a while.
I agree, my mother said, touching my hair fondly for a moment. My father tried to glare at me, but he appreciated my intentions too much to be angry at me for siding with my mother. He smiled, too, as he raised an eyebrow.
Okay, fine. Maybe his little visit here this afternoon didn't cost us a penny.
Obviously it cost something, my mother said.
Oh, maybe not, my father said, a hint of sarcasm in his tone. He leaned across the table and kissed her once on the forehead. Maybe April Mudd is a great lure for a poet like our lawyer. Maybe it's downright seductive. Maybe it was the beauty of our mud alone that drew Stephen here.
I do the supermarket shopping as if nothing happened. It's surreal. Actually, the supermarket shopping is a little different now. I spent more time in the grocery store today than I have in years. An hour and a half. I think it usually takes me about 45 minutes. It's not that the lines were so long or people stopped me to talk. If anything, it seems like people go out of their way these days not to stop me. So I don't know exactly why the shopping took so long today. But I have a theory. I once read somewhere that work takes up as much time as you can give it. If you give a job 30 minutes, for example, you'll do it in 30 minutes. But if you can give it an hour, it'll take an hour. That makes sense. And I think that's what happened today at the grocery store. Normally I would have done the shopping in less than an hour because I'd have to be home for prenatals. Not today. Not anymore. At least not while I'm... And I love this expression. Out on conditions. What a concept. With a completely straight face, the judge set 5 conditions for my release. First, he said I had to agree to appear in court, and I had to keep in touch with my lawyer. Those 2 made sense. But then, like I'm this hardened criminal, he said I couldn't commit another crime, and I couldn't do any illegal drugs. The only condition that really bothers me, no, it doesn't bother me, it pisses me off and scares the hell out of me at the same time, is the midwifery one. I'm not allowed to practice my craft until this trial is over. That's the one that hurts. I'm not allowed to birth any babies. I'm not allowed to tend to any mothers. So today, instead of learning if Mae O'Brien had felt her little one kick, I did the grocery shopping. I bought beets. I looked at bottles of salad dressing. I picked out sodas with sugar for Rand and sodas without sugar for Connie. And I guess I did it all at the pace of a dead person. From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. My mother was charged with involuntary manslaughter and practicing medicine without a license on Wednesday, April 9th, a little over a week after the medical examiner had filed the final autopsy report. We knew on Tuesday night she'd be arrested the next day. Stephen had come to our house again on Tuesday, arriving this time at the end of the day and staying through dinner. My father seemed less concerned with the idea that the lawyer's meter was running than he had been the week before. Stephen was able to walk us all step by step through the process my mother would endure the next day, and make it seem like a series of tedious but commonplace formalities, rather than a series of increasing indignities that could lead eventually to jail. Nevertheless, the idea that my mother was being arrested fueled the darkest parts of my adolescent imagination, at the same time that it absolutely terrified the part of me that was still a little girl. My mother had adamantly refused to allow either Stephen or my father to drive her to Newport so she could discreetly turn herself in. Despite Stephen's assurances that turning herself in no way implied guilt, she insisted that the state would have to come to Reddington. If they want to arrest me, they'll have to come here.
Stephen had taken great pains at dinner the night before to make it clear to us that my mother would not go to jail the next day for one single moment. Nevertheless, my mother had to endure one astonishing moment for which Stephen had not prepared her, the conditions of release. Bill Tanner argued during the arraignment that a midwife, by her very nature, demonstrates a reckless disregard for authority and for the established medical norms of our society. A midwife, by nature, is an outlaw, someone who cavalierly puts women and babies at risk on a daily basis for no other reason than a mindless and backward distaste for the practice of modern medicine. Sybil Danforth has a long history of challenging the state, first as a war protester and now as a midwife, Tanner said. Given that history, and given the fact that she is now facing 15 years in prison if convicted, the state believes there is a real and significant danger of flight. Your Honor, we all know there's no risk of flight. None at all. My client has lived in the same house for almost a decade, and in the same town almost her entire life, Stephen said. Moreover, Mrs. Danforth faces the loss of her practice, such as it is, Tanner interjected. And let's not forget she's a mother, continued Stephen. She has a daughter in school here in Vermont whom she loves very much, and she has a husband with an established architectural practice. This is where her life is. This is where her roots have grown deep and taken hold. Mrs. Danforth isn't going anywhere. She has no job, Your Honor. Her career's in shambles. Her reputation has been irrevocably tarnished. There are just so many reasons for her to leave the Northeast Kingdom that we know there's a very great risk of flight, and so we'd like to see bail reflect that. The state would like to see bail set at $35,000. That's absurd, Stephen said. Just ridiculous. Not at all. Your Honor, $35,000 is roughly half the appraised value of the Danforths' home. We believe it's a sum sufficient to ensure that nothing happens to all those deep roots. A tragedy has brought us all here, the judge said, and we are probably about to embark upon a long road together. I, for one, can do without such hyperbole as outlaw this early into the process, especially since I expect I will witness even more grandiloquent and dramatic license later on. My sense is defense counsel is correct when he tells me Mrs. Danforth has no plans on leaving, and I see no reason to impose a monetary condition for release. It was the summer of motions. Just after the 4th of July weekend, Stephen filed a motion to have the case dismissed, arguing that even when all the evidence was viewed in the best possible light for the state, there was still absolutely no case. He said we would lose on this motion, which we did, but it would give him an opportunity to hear Bill Tanner's arguments and listen to some of his experts. 2 weeks after that, Stephen filed a motion to have my mother's statement from the night the state troopers came to our door suppressed. Stephen said the odds were we would lose this one too, but he thought there was at least a small chance we could keep her first formal recollections of Charlotte Fugit Bedford's death from becoming evidence. Then Stephen filed a motion to obtain Charlotte Bedford's medical records going back to her childhood. This motion he won. And he argued that we should be allowed access to the woman's correspondence that winter with her mother and her sister, as well as the audio tapes Asa made of the Sunday services at his church for the parishioners who were unable to attend due to weather or illness. After speaking to members of Asa's church, Patty had concluded that Charlotte was sicker than she had let on with my mother. I longed to be tucked in the summer I turned 14. An odd desire, only in that I hadn't had any longings of that sort in at least half a decade before then, but a yearning wholly explicable when I contemplated the loss of my mother and the dissolution of my family. I spent lots of time with Tom, much more so than during the school year. We would spend evenings together when he would return from his summer job and whole afternoons on his days off. We swam together in the river, often with Sadie Demarest and Raleigh McKenna and the boys who passed through their lives that summer. Other times, I was as likely to be found experimenting with eyeliner as with marijuana. Tom turned 16 early in August and started to drive, which I think terrified my parents as much as anything that summer. He didn't have a car of his own, but an advantage of coming from a family that owned an automotive garage and graveyard was that he always had one at his disposal. If my parents had not reached a point where they pined to see Tom as a son-in-law, they had grown from merely tolerating him to sincerely liking him. I think it speaks well of the young Tom Courts that he continued to come around even after Charlotte Bedford died. In the spring and summer between my mother's arraignment and trial, he dropped by especially often, both because he understood I needed him and because he wanted to show his alliance with my family. I know my parents appreciated that. My mother actually baked a cake for him the night before he turned 16, and showing his alliance with my family demonstrated no small amount of maturity and spine. After one of my mother's mothers had died, all of the small communities in which I lived, my village, my school, my circle of friends, were split. Some folks saw Charlotte Bedford's death as an indictment of midwifery generally, and of my mother's irresponsibility specifically. Other people would go out of their way to show their support for my family as we endured what they viewed as a lynching. The second group, I'm sorry to say, was considerably smaller than the first. Tom Quartz, however, never wavered, and so some afternoons I daydreamed of him tucking me in at the end of the day, or sitting in the rocker beside my bed through the night as I slept. I think I daydreamed of Tom watching over me in a vaguely fatherly capacity because I could no longer be protected that way by my own father. Just as Tom had turned 16 that summer, I had turned 14, and that meant I could no longer be held and embraced and cuddled by my dad in the way I once was. I can remember being lifted as a tiny girl into his arms and being hugged. To this day, I do not mind at all being held by a man with some stubble on his cheeks. Stephen and Rand want me pumped up, fired up, psyched. They want me ready for a fight. I think they're talking like that because it's football season, but it sounds very strange coming from Rand, because he's never really been into football. Like me, he's always seen it as this totally bizarre form of organized violence. But he's a man, and so I think that's the only language he has to inspire me. Those are the only words that he knows. I want to tell him. I want to tell him and Stephen both that it's hard to get fired up, when most of the time I'm just too busy being scared to death. But I think all they'll do then is worry about me even more than they already do. Besides, I think if I told them how frightened I am, the floodgates would open. Suddenly I'd be telling them that I'm scared I'm going to jail. I'm scared I'm going to have to give up my practice. And this fear wasn't so bad in the spring. It's only in the last month or so that it's really crept up on me. Sometimes I'm scared I might have made a mistake in March. It's possible. What if Charlotte Bedford really was still alive?
From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. Newport sits at the southern tip of Lake Memphremagog, a thin, cold lake that stretches 30 miles north to south. Perhaps a third of the lake is in the United States, while the rest is north of the border in Canada. Before my mother's trial began, I hated that lake. By the time it was over, I loathed it. As a child, there were some obvious reasons to despise it. It was hard to spell and impossible to pronounce. I know now that the name is the Abenaki term for beautiful waters, but in grade school it was merely a long chain of syllables at once incomprehensible and unpleasant. Even as a teenager, however, when I was no longer intimidated by the phonetics of the word, I disliked the lake. It always looked to me like the sort of lake that liked to swallow swimmers and small boats whole. Most people aren't like me, however. Most people think highly of Lake Memphremagog. And most people who spend any time at all in the courtroom at the Orleans County Courthouse are very glad the city of Newport meets the lake where it does. The courthouse sits on the top of the bluff on Main Street, and the courtroom is on the third, and therefore highest, floor of the century-old stone and brick box. The courtroom has three monstrously large windows facing the lake, a mere three blocks to the north. Jurors are granted a panoramic view of the waters, and the shapes and summits of Owl's Head and Bear Mountain in the distance. As the defendant, my mother had a spectacular view of the waters. She and Stephen shared a table by the window. As the defendant's daughter, I sat in the front bench, the one directly behind her, which meant the lake was an unavoidable and inescapable presence in the corners of my eyes as well. Fortunately, my mother did not share my dislike for Lake Memphremagog. With an awareness of how the media approached her trial and the role image would play in its history, she said something to my father and Stephen and me one night when we were leaving the courthouse that indicated in her mind the lake was not merely an impartial witness to the events occurring on the third floor. It was actually an ally of hers, of sorts. "Look where she's standing," my mother said, and she motioned toward the reporter from the CBS affiliate in Burlington who was speaking to a TV camera. "And look what's going to be in the background. That's where they all stand. Have you noticed?" We had not noticed it before, but we all understood instantly what my mother meant.
The woman was standing across the street from the courthouse, instead of in front of the building. Everyone who isn't here who thinks about this will remember that water, my mother continued. That's what they'll remember when they picture this whole thing. That lake. That amazing and mysterious lake. Any hope Stephen had that the trial would not commence before Christmas had evaporated by the time the Labor Day weekend approached. We all knew it would be a fall affair, and only 2 days after Labor Day itself, we were officially informed the trial would begin Monday, September 29th, and Stephen expected it would last at least 2 weeks, maybe three. During that unusually hot, arid summer, the case never lost what Stephen had referred to once around my mother as its prosecutorial energy. If anything, that person named Tanner seemed to me more rabid than ever as autumn arrived, as interested in persecuting my mother as he was in prosecuting her. Bill Tanner really was furious. Bill Tanner really was out for blood. Neither Tanner nor his staff could believe that my mother had rejected the state's offer of a mere year in jail, of which she'd probably only serve 6 or 7 months, and 6 years of probation in return for a guilty plea on the charge of involuntary manslaughter. They thought it was a tremendously magnanimous and merciful offer. Yes, she was expected to give up midwifery, but to them, that was a small price. Meanwhile, when the rumor of Tanner's offer circulated throughout the medical community, many doctors, especially obstetricians, were livid. The idea that a hippie midwife had killed some woman with a bedroom C-section and might only go to jail for a few months had a good number of physicians enraged beyond reason. It seemed to me that some of them were spending more time writing editorials or letters to newspapers than they were practicing medicine.
"You're really going to let Connie watch?" my grandmother asked my mother one Saturday in mid-September, as if I weren't there having lunch with the two of them at our kitchen table. "We're really going to let Connie watch," my mother said. I imagine in her younger days my grandmother had been an extremely tolerant woman. By the time Charlotte Fugit Bedford died, however, she had grown more conservative. Her own husband, my grandfather, had died 10 years earlier, and a decade of living alone had made her slightly skittish, wary, and quick to frown or find fault. Nevertheless, my Nonnie was still a warm and energetic woman when I was growing up. My mother's tendency to hug friends on sight was at least partly genetic, and I'll never lose my love for the vaguely floral, vaguely antiseptic smell of my Nonnie's hairspray. I'd get a strong whiff of it with every embrace. In any case, Nonnie tried hard to convince my parents to keep me away from the courtroom. She thought it would be a scarring experience. My parents, however, knew how desperately I wanted to be there. Moreover, I think they realized that it would be equally scarring for me to hear important details secondhand in the girls' bathroom at school. It seemed to me I had a moral responsibility to be present. In my mind, my appearance was an important show of solidarity with my mother. Besides, Stephen wanted me there. "Stephen thinks Connie here will be very helpful," my mother said to her mother, and she gave my arm a small squeeze. "It makes Mom a real person," I chimed in, paraphrasing a remark I had overheard Stephen make to my parents earlier that week. "And that makes it harder to convict her. Juries don't like to convict the kind of real people who might be their neighbors." My mother turned to my grandmother and continued, "Connie will be with me because I love her and I want her there, as long as she wants to be there. She's come this far with us. She may as well see it through." I didn't think I'd be scared once this thing began, but I am. I thought I'd get over it once I got here, once I was settled down in my chair. I was wrong. Or maybe I was just kidding myself the last few weeks. Stephen and Bill Tanner must have talked to 30 or 35 people today, and they still haven't agreed upon who will be on the jury and who won't. So, as Stephen said, we get to do this again tomorrow. I think there were 4 or 5 people up there today who hated me without even knowing me. It really frightened the hell out of me. From where I sit, I can see Lake Memphremagog. I'll bet that water's cold right now. Incredibly cold. This just isn't a good time of the year for a trial like this. At least for me. Everything's dying or going brown. I didn't used to mind the fall. I do this year. That's another thing that seems to be different with me since Charlotte died. Suddenly, I dislike the fall. There were moments today when I found myself staring at the water in the lake and getting the chills when I thought about where I might be when it freezes.
From the notebooks of Sybil Danforth, midwife. Doctors do not protest, they lobby.
They are not the sort of people who will stand around outside a courthouse with placards and sandwich boards. And so they did not stand on the steps of the Orleans County Courthouse. That responsibility fell upon the midwives. The Monday my mother's trial began, my family was greeted in Newport by somewhere between 60 and 70 people, counting the midwives and their clients. There were women whose faces I recognized, like Cheryl Visco and Megan Bluebow, Molly Thompson and Donnell Foligno, and there were a great many women and men I'd never seen before. Inside, we'd soon discover, were even more of my mother's clients, quietly knitting or nursing in the three back benches.